It looked like an unseelie stumbled on her while she was searching through the wreckage for food and water to bring us. Whatever did it also put rat poison in the water jugs she'd been collecting. We'd lost 2 more she-seers before we figured out that bit of twisted nastiness. If I ever find the unseelie that killed her, I'll do to it what it did to her, she said from between clenched teeth. Every last fucking bit of it. I forced myself to inhale and exhale slowly, carefully. I could change the subject right now. Never ask, never know. What did it do to her? I want to know the details, I said in a voice that must have sounded as terrible to her as it sounded to me. She gave me a weird look, so I added hastily, How can I help you get even with it if I don't know what it did? She eyed me with new interest and nodded. You carry the spear, and I hear you're a null. We might work well together. I didn't trust myself to speak, so I just nodded back. Leaning forward in a voice taut with rage, she told me every detail, interpreting my complete immobility and silence as an appropriate show of abject horror and like-minded rage. When she finished, she pushed to her feet, bristling with restless energy, told me she was due back at the Abbey and would catch up with me later, so we could get to work identifying the monster that had done such horrific things to Joe and go hunt it together. As the door banged shut, I hung my head, and after a long, wheezing inhale, during which so much pain exploded inside my chest that it locked me down from lungs to lips, I doubled over, heaving in silent, suffocating convulsions, pounding the floor with my fist. Finally, just when I thought I might die, a sob ripped free from my throat with such force that it burned like fire and I began to cry. No, I began to keen. No, I began to gnash my teeth and tear at my hair and wail like my Irish ancestor's legendary banshee. I knew what monster had killed Joe. Me. 34. Stay with me. Let's just breathe. Jada. I was so irritated. I didn't even think of accessing the slipstream. I walked like a Joe, hands shoved deep in my pockets, scowling at the day, muttering beneath my breath, unaware of the passage of either scenery or time, until I realized I was standing in the middle of the green at Trinity College. I stopped walking and took stock of myself. I was feeling dangerously like Danny again. That was unacceptable. I had a world to save, and a personal mission I had to find time for. The past 24 hours felt as surreal as if I'd been battling Silverside again. Although in Dublin 35 days had passed, for me it was a mere 24 hours, give or take a few. And those 24 hours had been jam-packed with crises, each carrying significant emotional currency. The battle at the Abbey, watching my women die, the fire, Shazam and my meltdown, Riordan burning himself, the sweeper capturing us, Mac's sacrifice, dealing with the cuff and cruise, hacking off Riordan's head with my sword, trying to predict the Shisa Doo's moves, Mac regaining control over the book, joining us in Riordan's office, then losing it again. The Shisa Doo grabbing me in that scant split second I'd still been processing Mac's transformation, swiping the spear and nearly strangling me, the floor dropping out beneath us, falling, getting up, and dashing into the White Mansion in a desperate bid to position the stones around her before she reached the Queen. Failing. The Queen passing the true magic of her race into Mac, and shoving her back through the mirror so we could contain her while she was immobilized. The painful mixture of triumph and grief, as I'd watched the blue-black wall flare into life, incarcerating my friend in a prison where I'd had no idea what hell she might suffer. We'd only just reconnected again. I dropped down onto a bench, turned my face up to faint tendrils of sun that penetrated a dense cloud cover, and just breathed. I smiled faintly, remembering the moment Mac had stepped out of the prison, leaving the Shisa Doo behind. Then I scowled, thinking about Saint Riordan. Then I got a hold of myself, emptied my mind of everything, centered myself with my breath, stood and performed a kata to re-engage my energy. Abandoning myself to the fluid motion, I became nothing but a strong young body capable of fueling a stronger young mind. By the time I permitted myself to remember the past 24 hours again, they rolled off me like water from a duck. I was calm, energized, and ready for the day. My feet had taken me to the place I needed to be. They usually did. Some might say they hadn't the night I'd run from Mac and leapt into the Hall of Alt Days, but I didn't see things like that. As if there were clearly defined right and wrong turns in life, there was what I'd done and what I was going to do. Right now, it was time to add my brain power to the mental energy being harnessed at Trinity College and amp it up a few 100,000 kilowatts. I found Dancer alone in a long, narrow laboratory in the physics building, beneath a bank of windows through which intermittent shafts of sunlight spilled. He was peering into a microscope, oblivious to my presence, so I paused in the door watching him. I used to watch him a lot when we were young, wait until he was engrossed in a video game or movie, and stare unabashedly. I'd thought he had the most beautiful eyes I'd ever seen. I'd admired his hair, the way he sprawled like a cat soaking up sun, how he often smiled at an inner thought, sometimes laughed out loud. His hair was a mass of dark tousled waves that told me he'd been thinking hard, running his hands through it incessantly. He had on tight, straight-legged faded jeans, black hiking boots, and a black t-shirt with the words, "I'm like pie, really long, and I go on forever." There were two pencils stuck behind his left ear. I couldn't see his right one, but was willing to bet he had a couple stuck behind that one, too. He stood, peering into the scope, and when he raised his hand to adjust it, the muscles in his shoulder bunched and smoothed out again. I narrowed my eyes, noticing how well-defined his arm was, and that his skin was lightly tanned from stretching out in the sun on those rare days it shone. When did he develop that biceps? How did I miss how thick his forearms were, my geeky, hunky friend? When did his shoulders get so cut? And how had I missed the swell of his traps? My gaze dropped in an objective inquiry to ascertain whether the rest of him matched. It did. And I was struck again by the notion that I'd simply not seen him when I was young. I'd found him attractive in a boy genius way. I'd failed to notice he was a man. "Hey," I said, nipping that bud of thought before it blossomed further. His head whipped up, and he moved so fast he caught a beaker with his elbow and knocked it over. It tumbled from the counter, hit the floor, and shattered before he could catch it. He stared at me a long moment, then said coolly,
"So, you're back. Again."
I offered him a smile and said lightly, "Back like Jack, in like Flynn, ready to brainstorm like..." I couldn't think of a name that rhymed with brainstorm. "Einstein? On his best day?" He didn't smile back. He looked tired, and there were dark circles under his eyes. Grabbing a nearby broom, he yanked the dustpan from the handle and began sweeping up the broken glass. Without taking his gaze from the floor, he said,
"It's been 35 days. 4 hours and..."
He looked at his watch.
16 minutes since you were last seen alive, in case you were wondering. But I doubt you were. Time doesn't mean the same thing to you that it means to some of us. That's how long you were gone this time, as near as I was able to calculate. You were last spotted leaving Chester's the night of August 8th.
If the way he was beating the floor into submission with his broom was anything to gauge his mood by... He was seriously mad at me. I'd considered the past 24 hours. I'd had a job to do. I'd done it. "I'm sorry," I said simply, and I meant it. That day, so many years ago, when he'd gotten mad at me for disappearing into the Silvers with Christian, I'd gotten mad right back. But I'd learned a few things since then, such as, it's pure hell when you care about someone and suddenly they're gone and you don't know if you'll ever see them again. I moved into the room and waited for him to stop assaulting the floor with a cleaning implement. He kept at his angry sweeping for a few moments without saying a word, then finally stopped and looked up at me. His gaze was guarded, remote. "I mean it," I said softly. "I'm sorry." Time really didn't move the same way where I was. It was critical I go back into the White Mansion. For me, it was only 24 hours.
How long before you went into the Silvers did you know you had to go?
He was asking if there'd been enough time that I might have left him a note or gotten a message to him somehow. As long as it took me to freeze frame directly from Chester's to the White Mansion. Critical means at an immediate point of crisis. He propped the broom against the counter and gazed into my eyes, searching deep. I had no idea what he was looking for, or what he decided he found, but he finally relaxed through his shoulders and said softly,
"Well then, damn glad you're back, Mega."
"Damn glad to be back, Dancer." And just like that, there was no tension left in the room. I loved that about him. He didn't even need to know what I'd done. Only the parameters of it that affected the respect and consideration he felt was due if I wanted to be his friend. I hated that he'd been worrying about me again. I hated the dark circles beneath his eyes. So I extended an olive branch, something I'd never done in the past. It made me uncomfortable, but I would have been more uncomfortable not doing it. "If it's at all possible, I promise to get word to you if I ever have to go into the Silvers again." He inhaled sharply, not missing that what I'd just said accorded a degree of accountability to him I'd never permitted before. I meant it. The next time I had to go somewhere, I would bloody well find a way to leave him a note. His grin was instant and blinding. Then he was talking a mile a minute, catching me up on all the work they'd been doing, outlining the preferred theories, eyes sparkling. Dancer was convinced the black holes suspended slightly above the Earth weren't remotely the same as the ones in outer space.
"I think the ones up there,"
he jerked his head toward the ceiling,
"are naturally occurring phenomena. They have the right to be what and where they are. The theory is that primordial black holes were birthed at the dawn of time, have always existed, and for some reason need to. I like to think of them as the universe's trash collectors, gathering up old defunct detritus, clearing the way for new things to be born. The holes we're dealing with don't behave in accordance with modern black hole theory. While it's possible modern black hole theory is wrong, I mean, bloody hell, we believe Newtonian laws right up until Einstein turned everything on its ear. The smell I get off our black holes is that they're anathema to the universe. They don't belong, should never have come into existence, and are in complete defiance of the natural order of things."
"They smell? I never noticed a smell, and I have a super sniffer." He ducked his head, looking mildly embarrassed.
"They say a great physicist is distinguished by his ability to sniff out the difference between a superior theory and one not worth pursuing."
I smiled. "Well then, you've definitely got a super sniffer too." He grinned.
"I suspect these entities are literally spheres of unmaking in, well, I hate to say a magical sense, because I tend to lean toward everything being explainable by science, but I also believe in God, and the Fae are real, and maybe magic is just a word for those things we can't yet explain or understand."
"What does this tell us about how to get rid of them?"
"That the song of making is likely the only thing that has a chance."
He was silent a moment, and his eyes got that dreamy, faraway look that told me he was happily pondering a highly abstract concept.
"A melody of creation. Think of it, Mega,"
he exclaimed.
"That math and frequency might actually be capable, on some level we don't understand, of creating new things, repairing damaged ones."
He shook his head.
"There's something about the concept that resonates with me. Makes sense on a gut level, but it's so bloody far beyond my ability to interpret and elucidate that I feel like a child, staring up at the night sky, wondering what the Milky Way is. Regardless, the fabric of our world is unraveling and has to be stitched back together again somehow. And I believe the song the Fae used to know is the only thing that's going to work. An unseelie created the holes. It seems quid pro quo that a seelie must repair them. Maybe, if we had a few centuries to work on the song, we'd get somewhere, but I don't think we have a tenth that much time.
Months, I told him grimly. Perhaps even less. His eyes widened.
You know that for sure?
I nodded. He plunged his hands into his hair, raking it back.
Mega, we're at a complete impasse with the song. We need some kind of clue, a fragment of the melody. Then at least I'd understand what I'm aiming for, and stand a chance at figuring out what the bloody hell it is.
I pressed a hand to my forehead. It was hot. I couldn't recall the last time I'd eaten, and was abruptly aware I was dangerously hungry. Do you have anything high-calorie to eat around here?
Always.
He led me to a small room off the back of the laboratory where a fridge was loaded with food. There were boxes and boxes of chilled protein bars, peanut butter, even beef jerky and milk. Where did you get all this? I reached for the glass jar of milk, topped with a yellow layer of heavy cream, mouth-watering.
Riotin,
he said, and rolled his eyes.
He's bloody well taken over the bloody world, and suddenly everyone has food. Which means he had it all along and just wasn't sharing. Got this too.
With his foot, he nudged a box toward me, filled with canned goods. Chocolate syrup! I unscrewed the top off the milk, squeezed the chocolate in, recapped the glass bottle, and shook the milk hard enough to mix. I guzzled it for several long seconds, only stopping with a twinge of embarrassment when there were a few inches left to ask him hastily, "Did you want any of this?" When he shook his head, smiling faintly, I finished it and chased it with two protein bars. That was better. I could feel myself cooling down already. "We have the queen," I told him.
"What?"
he exploded.
"And you're just now telling me this? Where is she? How did you get her to come back here?"
I filled him in on what had happened in the past day, my time, omitting the parts about my meltdown and Shazam and killing Riordan and Mac calling me a cunt. He was pacing, repeatedly raking his hands through his hair by the time I finished.
"I need to talk to Mac. Now. Like this very instant."
If Mac had any information about the song, she'd already be here sharing it. I think it's going to take time for her to decipher what the Queen passed on and figure out how to use it.
"Time is the one thing we don't have,"
he said darkly. When I left, after promising to return later that night so he could demonstrate his latest invention, "And maybe we could take it out for a test drive," he'd said, eyes sparkling, I headed down the hall and was about to access the slipstream when I saw Kiva hurrying down the corridor toward me. The moment she saw me, her eyes filled with glacial hostility. I considered kicking up and blasting past her with an elbow casually protruding, but that was something Danny would have done, so I sludged along in slow-mo. We approached each other with equal coolness. I couldn't help but wonder if she was his girlfriend now. She sure acted like she was, or his keeper. We drew up a few feet apart. "You," she said with icy disdain. "Kiva," I said tonelessly. "Why did you even bother coming back? We don't need you, and I sure as hell don't want you here. It was a grand month without you around." "I'm just his friend," I said in a voice void of inflection. "No, you're not," she spat. "If you were his friend, you wouldn't cause him so much worry, make him take so many careless risks. If you were his friend, you'd realize he may have a super brain, but he's no bloody superhero. A true friend wouldn't subject him to constant disappearances and reckless shenanigans with no consideration whatsoever for what's good for him." I studied her objectively, trying to define the origin of her hostility. It seemed as if it had to be more than mere jealousy, and I didn't see any reason for her to be jealous of me. "I've never kissed him," I finally said, thinking that might diffuse the tension between us. Discord was illogical. We had too many problems already. We couldn't afford to create more for ourselves. She tossed her head impatiently.
Oh, you think that's what this is about? I'm jealous. Why don't you try pulling your selfish head out of your selfish ass? Yes, I love Dancer. I freely admit it. Most of the women here do. He's damn near impossible not to love. Funny, sweet, thoughtful, brilliant. But this is about his well-being, not mine. That's what love is, how it behaves. But you obviously don't know a thing about it. The only person you love is yourself. Did you make plans to dash off and indulge in another one of your little adventures with him tonight? Whiz him about at speeds he was never meant to endure while you goof off and play being superheroes together. I guess the look on my face gave me away because she narrowed her eyes and hissed, If you can't be selfless enough to protect the health of the one man that has a chance of figuring out how to save our world, then you need to stay away from him. Far away from him. Like go get lost all over again, only never bloody come back this time. She shoved past me and stormed off down the hall. I whirled and stalked after her. She said something I didn't understand and didn't like, and it had sent a chill racing up my spine. What do you mean, protect the health? I growled at her back. What are you talking about? Dancer's young and strong. He works out and looks amazing. He's perfectly healthy. She whirled, eyes flashing. Aye, he spends hours working out every day while he ponders his theories, and he shouldn't. It's not good for him. You know why he does it? To keep up with you? To get you to see him as a man? He can't do cardio, so he does isometrics. Pitting muscle against muscle to build strength without overloading himself. Planks, crunches, tension exercises, and the like. He's obsessed with looking like those men you hang out with. God, I wish he'd just stop wanting you. My stomach had turned into a blender on high speed and was threatening to propel the milk I'd drunk out the lid of my mouth. Why can't he do cardio? Why isn't working out good for him? She looked at me a long moment, then a bit of the fury eased from her face and her eyes widened faintly. She took a few steps toward me and said, wonderingly, For the love of Mary? You don't even know, do you? All of us do, but not you. Apparently not. Pressing a hand to my stomach, I shook my head. He never told you, she said incredulously. Repeating the same bloody question in a slightly different way is still the same bloody question, I hissed. What the bloody hell was wrong with Dancer? What did everyone know that I didn't know? Do I fucking look like I have any idea what you're talking about? I practically shouted. Her face changed, as if she was seeing me for the first time. Well, then, she murmured. At least I don't have to keep hating you. I hate hating people. Good to know. So what the bloody hell is it that I don't know about Dancer? I ground out between clenched teeth. She smiled. But it was a terrible, sad smile. Danny, Jada, whatever it is you're calling yourself these days, our lad has a bad heart. He came that way. I thought you knew. 35. To everything, turn, turn, turn. Mac. I opted for no makeup. Swiped balm on my lips because they were so dry, stepped back and studied my reflection in the bathroom mirror. Even with the lights off, I could tell my eyes were red, and it was obvious I'd been crying. But I could blame that on any number of things and be believed. I curled on the floor of the shower, sobbing for a long time, wondering if all the images the Shisa-Do had forced on me were true. Had I done every one of those terrible things? Killed so many? With such chilling brutality and barbarism? I'd laid on the tile floor, reliving each detail the book had showed me, owning every bit of it. Joe's death had been the truth. That told me they very likely all were. I'd done unforgivable things I could never undo. My choice to take a spell from the Shisa-Do to save Danny's life had cost the lives of many others. And there was no way I could make my books on those accounts balance. Not just cost the lives, let us be perfectly precise.
my hands, my body, had killed them. I wallowed in shame and grief. I shuddered, wept, and screamed. Then I forced myself to stop, collect the savage murder of Joe and the other unforgivable crimes I'd committed, put them in a box, and shut the lid. I despised using one of the Shisadu's tactics, but it was effective, and hating myself for my sins would have to wait, as was whatever act of atonement I would eventually make. Not that there was any act of atonement that would mean a thing to those I'd killed. Putting them away didn't mean the pain was gone. I carried it. I would always carry it. But because I'd been given the Queen's power, my state of mind was too critical to everyone's survival for me to let myself fall apart now. It simply wasn't an option. It occurred to me while lying on the floor that grief's drink recipe is 2 parts tribute to the person you loved and 4 parts feeling sorry for yourself because you lost them. Or, in the case of Joe and the others, 4 parts extreme self-loathing. Either way, grief was self-indulgent, and that was something I had no right to be. If we survived, I'd have oodles of time to hate myself all I wanted. Currently, I was the only one who could wield the Song of Making, and that meant I didn't get to be anything less than 100% focused on our situation. I was a soldier on the front line, and soldiers don't get the luxury of addressing their issues until the war is over and everyone's safe. I began to turn away from the mirror, then narrowed my eyes and glanced back. Something about me was different. What was it? I dried my hair upside down as usual, and my eyes were green, not black. My teeth were almost blindingly white since I'd brushed them about 100 times, trying not to think about what had been lodged between them. Frowning, I fumbled behind me for the light switch and flipped it on. Holy hell, I look like the Khaleesi! I exploded, jumping back from the mirror. I'd showered and dried my hair in the dark, in no mood to see myself clearly. The streaks of crimson paint were gone, and my hair was blonder than I'd ever seen it, nearly white. I tucked my chin down and peered at my part. Yep, all the way to the roots. I gathered a handful of it, examining the length, trying to remember how long it had been a few days ago. It sure seemed to be a few inches longer now than I recalled. The Seely Queen's hair had spilled past her waist in a thick platinum fall. Christian's hair had turned from rich chestnut to inky black. Was I turning Seely? Would the true magic actually transform me into a fae? Cripes. First a She-Seer, with the blood of the unseely king in my veins, then the Shisadu, now a full-on fairy queen. It was beginning to look like being just Mac had never been in the cards for me. I narrowed my eyes. Maybe my changes would only go partway, like Christian's. He'd managed to arrest, even reverse his transformation to a degree. Then again, this wasn't a transformation I could afford to resist. I needed all the juice she'd given me, no matter the price. After a moment, I growled at my platinum-haired reflection. Well, buck up, little buckaroo, in my best John Wayne voice. What I look like, even whatever I might eventually become due to the gift Aviel had given me, and it was a gift, because it could save our world, didn't mean shit. The only thing that mattered was what I did with it. I hurried down the stairs, entering my paint-stained, wrecked store from the rear. I paused in the doorway, leaning against the jamb, studying it. The critical factor now was we needed the song. But an equally critical factor was, assuming we got it, what power had I been given and how was I supposed to use it? I had no idea how fae magic worked. I remembered standing in the street, at the head of Darok's army of Unseelie, watching as Valaine made Drelia's mouth disappear. Unlike when he'd sealed the door to the boudoir with a sealed gate, he'd not said a word when he altered her face. He hadn't even glanced at her. So what had he done? Was it based on the power of mere thought? The higher the caste of Fae, the stronger the power? I studied the room with dried spray paint streaked everywhere, the shattered bookcases, the broken lamps and magazines and chairs,
I'd only managed to clean a third of the smaller debris out the last time I'd worked on it. I closed my eyes and painstakingly began to create a mental image of the way it had looked the day I first stumbled from the dark zone through the front door. So damned naive. And met Barron's for the first time. When I'd opened the tall, diamond-paned door to the seemingly modestly-sized four-story building and discovered the cavernous bookstore within, I'd fallen in love with every inch of the elegant old-world place with its antique rugs, sumptuous Chesterfields, enameled gas fireplaces, acres of books, even the old-fashioned cash register. I lavished detail on the room I was building in my mind. Only when I could see my bookstore with perfect clarity, exactly the way it had been that day, did I open my eyes. Still wrecked. Not a damn thing had changed. Okay, that hadn't worked. Time wasn't my friend. I needed to figure this out fast. I was rather relieved it hadn't worked because it had taken me too long. Blaine had removed Drelia's mouth effortlessly and instantly, and I didn't believe for a minute that if things got critical and I had to do something to save us, my potential adversary might wait patiently for me to picture whatever I wanted to do with crystal-clear perfection. I dropped down onto a crate, buried my head in my hands and sank into myself, seeking the shining vault I'd claimed for my own. Quite certain it was no more an actual vault than there'd ever been an actual book or box inside me. But what was it? And how did I access it? I went still, disconnecting from my body, remembering what it had felt like to be consciousness and not one thing more, and focused. There it was. Rays of dazzling gold radiated from the smooth, gilded surface of it, and I could feel raw, ferocious power emanating from within. I welcomed it, embraced it, basked in the bright golden light it was throwing off, and grew warm all over, as if absorbing rays of sun. I experienced a sudden whooshing sensation, as if I was being yanked from one location to another. Then, abruptly, I was somewhere else. My eyes flew open. I stood near an enormous alabaster altar, on top of a hill that looked very much like Tara, only bigger. More dramatic and otherworldly. At the bottom of the high, vast mound, a thousand or more mighty megaliths that shimmered with iridescent fire encircled the base, with only small spaces between. A soft breeze tousled my hair. The sky above me was dark, glittering with stars, and three enormous moons that hung abnormally near the planet. One was so close, low, and directly above me that I felt as if it might drop on my head and crush me. The entire mound was carpeted with lush, velvety flowers that bobbed and swayed in the breeze, scenting the night air with perfume. High in the sky, dark, leathery-winged hunters sailed past the two more distant moons, gonging deep in their massive chests. Nightbirds sang an exquisite synchronized melody. It was so overwhelmingly beautiful to all my senses that it hurt. I closed my eyes, inhaling deeply, wondering where I was.
What have you come for?
A bodiless voice demanded. I kept my eyes closed, the better to answer with an undistracted mind. Opening them would have done me no good anyway. The voice had been huge, coming from everywhere at once. The stones, the earth, even the moons. The true magic of the Fey race, I said strongly.
What will you do with it?
My answer was instant and effortless. Protect and guide.
How will you achieve it?
With wisdom and grace.
Are you equal to it?
Well, shit. That felt like a trick question. Yes, displayed arrogance. No displayed weakness. I inhaled deeply of the jasmine and sandalwood-scented breeze and searched myself. The ego that was undivided for the first time in my entire life. For the answer, my daddy, Jack Lane, would have given. Because it was the right one. And said quietly, I will do everything in my power to be equal to it. I gasped as I felt something warm and good settle over me, like a full-body cloak. It draped me completely from head to toe, seeping into my skin and deeper still, pooling inside me like molten gold. Still, I kept my eyes closed, because I'd learned recently how clear a lack of visual distractions kept my mind. As it filled me, I felt as if I was becoming a small star, blazing from within, ancient and calm and watchful, and as essential to the universe as any of those stars above me. My head whipped back, my body drew taut, as radiance drenched my being. I opened my eyes, held out my hand, and looked at it. I was glowing, translucent, ethereal, my body no longer solid.
You are not Fae.
It was a judgment, not a favorable one. I said simply, I have the blood of the Unseelie King in me, and Queen Avil chose me to be her successor. I did battle with the entity known as the Shisadu and won. The true race is in danger of extinction. I will do everything in my power to prevent that. I felt a sentient presence gust close then. It entered me, joining the brilliance that filled me, and although it was instinct to want to resist, especially after what the book had done to me, I quelled it quickly and trusted what my gut was saying. This sentience was non-threatening. It felt vast and wise, gentle and pure. It gusted through my being, leaving no corner untouched by its soft tendrils. I felt as if it was probing into the fundamental elements of my soul, examining every component of every belief I held and every action I'd made.
You recently committed acts of great evil.
There was nothing left in me but honesty. I couldn't have lied if I wanted to. I offered it my sorrow, my sins, my grief. I did, I answered sadly.
Why?
Another trick question. An evil book made me do it, displayed blame displacement and weakness. I was possessed and not myself, displayed a lack of personal responsibility and yet more weakness. Because I made mistakes, I said finally, with a strangely nuanced sorrow I'd never felt before. There was a difference between being sad and feeling sorrow. Sad was about yourself. Sorrow was big as the world and encompassed all of it.
Will you make those mistakes again?
I answered without hesitation. No, I suspect I'll make entirely new ones and carry the pain of those too. I felt as if the thing inside me smiled.
Then it is yours, as are the Tuatha De Danann. Guide them well.
There was another whooshing sensation, and I felt the crate beneath my butt. I was back in the bookstore, head still in my hands, gasping at the suddenness of the transition, pained by my abrupt eviction from the starry-skied paradise and loss of communion with the wise, gentle thing that had interrogated me and deemed me fit. I wouldn't let it down. Inhaling deeply, I raised my head. Baron's books and baubles looked exactly like it had the day I'd first stepped inside it. Late afternoon sunshine slanted in the front windows of the bookstore, spilling across the back of the Chesterfield, warming my shoulders. I nibbled on the tip of my pen and scanned my list. World goals, not in order. 1. Get the music box to Dancer so we can determine exactly what it is. I know it has something to do with the song. I felt it that day in the White Mansion. 2. Dispatch scouts into the Silvers and find a world humans can survive on. Start making plans to relocate them. They'll have to be fully settled on the planet, not in the Silvers, because I don't know what will happen to the Silvers if our planet dies. 3. Find Cruz and make him my ally. Persuade him to teach me how to use the magic I have. Find out what he knows. He not only has part of the Shisadu that allegedly contains information about the song, Was that just one of the many lies he'd told me as Valaine? But worked beside the Unseelie King for eons as he tried to recreate the lost melody. Cruz has more knowledge of ancient history than anyone. 4. Find out what's going on with the Fae, Seelie and Unseelie. Figure out how to organize them and unite humans and Fae together toward the goal of finding the song. I chewed on my pen and thought, yeah, that was going to be a challenge. Like they were going to accept me, a human, as their leader and queen. I knew what the Fae were like. They responded to threats and displays of power. And so far, the only thing I'd figured out how to do was clean up my bookstore. I'd spent the past few hours sitting on the couch in front of a lightly hissing gas fire, doing the closest thing to meditating I'd ever done, trying to fathom what was inside me now. It had all seemed so clear, so pure, the power so tangible and understandable when I was standing on the hill beneath Three Moons. But I'd been translucent and ethereal then, and I was no longer. I was solid and human again, and although I could feel power rippling beneath my skin, I didn't know how to access and direct it. I suppose this was how Christian felt, with no brotherly prince to help him understand what he was. I scribbled another one down. 5. Go to the Abbey and rebuild it the way I did the bookstore. Restore the She-Seers home so they can gather all the lore they have and begin searching it. Do I have the power to recreate things that got burned, like books? How am I supposed to rebuild the Abbey? I don't even know what each room looked like. Do I need to? 6. Talk to Barons about talking to Dagus to see what he knows. Personal goals. 1. Find my parents and spend time with them. Bring them up to date so they can help. 2. Find out if Alina still exists. I stopped writing and sighed. I had serious doubts on that score. After watching the book create multiple versions of me with substance, I'd concluded that was all Alina had ever been. And what had I done with my chance to spend time with her again, even as an illusion? I'd driven her away repeatedly, interrogated and bullied her. Only at the end had I finally accepted her, made plans to have coffee and breakfast, a date I'd never gotten to keep. I shoved the tangle of emotion into another handy box and resumed writing. 3. Talk to Danny about Shazam. Determine if he's real, and if so, figure out how to help her. If he's not real, figure out how to help her times 10. 4. Barons. I didn't elucidate on the Barons' personal goal. It was purely selfish, as were all my personal goals. But since the world might cease to exist in the very near future, I intended to spend at least some time with the people I loved. The bell on the door tinkled as it opened and banged shut again. My body tightened with familiar tension and I smiled. Barons was there, behind me, reading over my shoulder in silence. After a moment he said,
"Ah, so I'm a personal goal of yours."
"Something like that."
"Care to elaborate?"
I did. Tossing aside my notebook, I turned around on the sofa, knelt on the cushions, and looked up at him. I'd intended to pull his head down and kiss him, but I ended up just sitting there, gazing at him.
"What a creature you've become."
His dark eyes gleamed. "I know, right?"
"Nice hair, Mac."
"Thanks. What happened to Ms. Lane? I'm not dying. I don't think you're about to kill me, and we're not having sex."
"She doesn't live here anymore."
"She doesn't? Was he throwing me out? Would he do that? Tell me I had to go live with the Fae now?"
"It's nice to meet you, finally, Mac."
His eyes glittered with unguarded appreciation and passion. I stared up at him, then shook my head with a wry smile, resisting the urge to slap a hand to my forehead. It was so simple, so clear, and had mystified me for so long. I'd told myself it was just the way we were, preferring a persona of distance in public and another intimate, sacred one in private. But that had never been it at all, or at least not all of it.
I might never know if it was the Shisa Du's presence inside me that kept me so conflicted about everything for so long. And once it was gone, I finally gained that long-sought clarity of being. Or, if it had been through the very process of standing my ground and defeating it that I'd achieved such clarity. But it didn't matter. The end result was the same. Some shadowy, self-destructive, confused place no longer existed inside me. I was of a single, clear mind. There were goals, and there were methods to attain them. There were my chosen responsibilities, and those things I was willing to do to honor them. There were the things I was willing to live with, and the things I wasn't willing to live without. There was a quiet, deep, abiding love of myself, flaws and all, and I had plenty, and the world around me, and it had plenty too. My eyes shimmered, and later, barons would tell me they'd glowed with iridescent fire. It's nice to meet you too, Jericho. I pulled his head down and kissed him. 36. I am the Lizard King. I can do anything. Shisa Du. My enemies underestimate me. Encumbered by emotion, their faulty brains fail to apprehend the altered variables, particularly the new one introduced by Michaela walking away from me. Walking away from me will never be permitted. She is my horse to break and always will be. The force field erected by the stones was designed to hold my essence, doubly trapped. First by the covers of the spelled tome, second by the field. Or first by a body, second by the field. Without the primary barrier, I exceed the prison's capacity to contain me. Although it takes time to divine the method, and is perilous. For an instant I nearly dissipate into a storm of black dust shaped like a cube. My will is equal to the task. A small, dark cloud, I hover above the cocooned, unseelie princess. So thoughtful of them to leave me a body. I would lose cohesion quickly in this form. Again, the universe favors my supremacy, colludes with me to attain my desires. It recognizes the supremacy of my being. The runes I plastered upon the dark phase skin fall away at my command, and the princess stirs. When she rolls over, mouth slightly ajar, I aim myself at the aperture and drive myself in. She goes rigid, screaming as she resists, but she is puny. And I am vast. I possess her quickly, saturating every atom. I realize the moment I attach to her neural network, unlike Michaela, who I will torture for all eternity. This Unseelie is incapable of holding me for long. My refusal to jump bodies yesterday was wise. The only reason Michaela was able to walk away from me and leave me was because she had a force field with which to winch us apart. But the stones are here in the White Mansion, where time flows differently. And she is out there, where I will soon be. It would take a month or more, Earth time, for anyone to retrieve them. I require very little time to execute my new plan. The bulk of it will be lost making my exit from this place. My new vessel jerks clumsily when I command it to hurry for the door. Weak, puny thing. But it will last long enough. I hurry out onto black marble floors, turn left, then right, seeking crimson, cursing the ever-changing white mansion the bastard king fashioned for his concubine. Each wrong turn I take equates to days slipping away, Earth time. A month or more will have passed by the time I escape this maze. Michaela will be able to feel me coming once I exit the Silvers, but she will believe me body-bound, giving me the advantage. I will take back what is mine. Then, I will destroy this motherfucking world. Invisible.
I suppose she must have begun thinking about how different her life would be without me. She couldn't travel, couldn't really make friends or have company in, or even go out at night, because what kind of mother would she be if she left her daughter locked in a cage and didn't come home? I sometimes wonder if she met someone who told her things that made her unhappy with her life, because she seemed to change overnight. She still sat with me in the evenings and did all those mom things, but she rarely smiled anymore, and she started to get lines around her mouth and eyes. Her lips pulled down much more often than up, and I couldn't reach her through the bars to push her cheeks into a smile. I was 6.5 years old when she fell in love. She told me about him, how kind he was and how much he cared about her. She told me he was going to marry her, us, that she would tell him all about me when the time was right. He took her on trips every weekend, and the first night she left me alone, I cried every time I woke up. But when she came back, she was like she used to be when I was little, before I ever freeze-framed, happy and excited, cooing to me and talking about plans for our future again. Then, one night, a week before my 7th birthday, she came home really late and soaking wet, and just walked right past my cage without even looking at me, went into her bedroom and closed the door. Her expression was so terrible as I'd stared up excited to see her, that I hadn't said any of the interesting funny things I'd planned all day to say. I just curled up and listened to her cry all night. I was pretty sure he decided not to marry us. I think he broke her heart. My 7th birthday came and went, but she didn't notice. For the first time, there was no Irish stew and ice cream, and no shared stories of one day. I celebrated anyway, having an imaginary meal with my imaginary dog, Robin, that lived in my cage with me and could talk and told the funniest jokes, and we were always cracking ourselves up. One day, we were going to both be older and go outside, and we were going to zoom around everywhere in the city that we wanted to go, and we were going to fix other people's problems for them, because that was just about the nicest thing you could do for anyone, was notice them and fix their problems, and sometimes even just spend time with them. After that, she stopped going away on weekends. For a while, we didn't have very much food, and she no longer wore the work uniform she used to wear. Then, one day, she dressed up so pretty and went to work in the afternoon, and came home much later than she used to. She started bringing bottles of wine home with her, instead of groceries or carry-out. She'd slide a heat and serve into my cage, and instead of telling me about her day, or daydreaming with me about our plans, she'd drink in silence, staring at late-night TV, while I'd tried desperately to say something that would make her smile, or even look at me. She began coming home even later after work, sometimes early in the morning, and when she did, she was slurring and stumbling, and sometimes she was so very, very nice, and sometimes she was really not. Sometimes it was nearly dawn, with me pinching myself and making up all kinds of new games in my head to stay awake, eager to see her and tell her about the things I learned on TV that day, and what life was going to be like when I was older and could go outside with her. I was sure if we could just go outside together, everything would be all right again. One night, she didn't come home at all. It went that way for a while. Every 4 or 5 days, she'd stay out all night. She lost weight and got dark smudges beneath her eyes. Then she didn't come home for 2 nights in a row. She stopped bringing bottles with her, but her slurring and stumbling got even worse. Then it was 3 nights. And when she finally did come home, she didn't look at me very much, and her eyes were unfocused and empty. Her gaze would kind of move around the room, then hurry up when they got to the cage. And I knew I was becoming invisible somehow. The more she didn't come home, the harder I tried when she was there to make her want to stay. I knew if I could just make her remember how much she loved me, she wouldn't want to leave. I'd never forgotten. I guess my world changed slowly, but it felt like it happened all at once. One day I just knew. I wasn't her daughter anymore. I was the dog she'd never wanted. 37. Wait until the war is over and we're both a little older. Jada. Time doesn't mean the same thing to you that it means to some of us, I couldn't shake Dancer's words from my mind. They seemed fairly innocuous when he flung them at me. They didn't anymore. No wonder he hated it every time I disappeared. Kiva told me his diagnosis but had refused to discuss it further. She'd said I needed to ask him about it. When she walked away, she glanced back with a look of pity and said softly, I really did think you knew. I'd not have disliked you so much otherwise. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I knew what it was. The disease that killed young athletes on the basketball court or football field, without warning, cutting them down in their prime. The symptoms. Fatigue, shortness of breath, inability to exercise, fainting, a sensation of pounding heartbeats, heart murmur. At times it might be manageable, other times it could be severe. I was pretty sure all those times he'd disappeared for a few days, he'd been having a bad spell and gone off alone, so I wouldn't know. The cause. Usually gene mutation. An abnormal arrangement of heart muscle cells called myofiber disarray. I'd watched a TV show about it, years ago when all I had to do with my time was watch TV. The severity of the disease varied widely. Most people had a form where the septum between the two bottom chambers of the organ became enlarged and impeded blood flow out of the heart. It was usually inherited. The thickened heart muscle could eventually become too stiff to effectively fill with blood, resulting in heart failure. Sudden cardiac death was rare, but when it happened, it was to young people under the age of 30. Young, athletic people, just like Dancer. The treatment was palliative, relieving symptoms and preventative, avoiding sudden cardiac death. Dancer had never breathed a word of it to me. We'd raced through the streets at dizzying, dangerous speeds, set off bombs and outrun them. He'd let me whiz him around in freeze frame, crashing him into all kinds of stuff, bruising him, hurting him, laughing his ass off the entire time. Now I understood why he'd like to laze on uncommon days of sunshine as boneless as a cat, soaking up the sun. Stillness was his friend. Being able to relax so completely might just be what had kept him alive this long. Now I understood why Kiva had stared daggers at me whenever she'd seen me. I might have killed him. You're going to get the boy killed one day, Raiden had said to me 5.5 years ago, Silverside time. Rotten purgatory, dude, I'd fired back. Batman never dies. Dancer won't either. But Batman didn't have a bad heart. Dancer did. When the door whisked silently open, I stalked into Raiden's office and dropped into the chair on the opposite side of the desk from him. In the month we'd been gone, the floor and walls had been replaced, and the office, like the man, was good as new. For a moment I just looked at him, appreciating that he was no longer charred to a human crisp, and his skin was golden and smooth. Except for the skein of scars at his throat and the long, wicked one that stretched from what I could see of his collarbone up to his left ear. Dressed as he usually was in dark pants and an impeccable crisp white shirt, sleeves rolled up, silver cuff glinting, he looked more like a business tycoon than something that I knew wasn't human. Sometimes had fangs, could move faster and knew far more powerful magic than me. I realized then, as I never had when I was young, that he'd chosen such civilized attire for precisely that reason, to make people think he was something other than the ruthless immortal being he was. I opened my mouth to give him the carefully scripted speech I'd worked on for the past hour, the one that was logical and persuasive and built gently to the point and came off as neither pushy nor needy, the deft, tactful speech that was going to win him over and guarantee his aid. But my mouth had other plans. And growled, How the bloody hell did you keep Dagus alive? Up until that moment, he'd been regarding me with more benign interest than I'd ever seen from him before. Weird fuck. I just killed him recently. Now he was all laid back. Benign vanished. A scowl stomped the living shit out of it and did a dance all over his face. He lunged from the chair, was around the desk, and had me on my feet, gripping me by my shoulders before I'd even processed that he'd moved. I would give Not just my eye teeth, but every last one of my teeth and wear dentures for the rest of my life if he teach me how to do that.
How do you know about Dagus?
He said with careful precision.